This is Matt Rogers from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Every friend group has that one person who puts their card down for brunch and sends the Venmo request.
If that's you and your Venmo balance is popping, you need a Venmo debit card so you can spend your balance instantly. No transferring anything, no waiting around.
So as soon as you get paid back for brunch, you can pay for those concert tickets you've been eyeing or put it toward your next night out.
Plus, there's no monthly fee or minimum balance.
Learn more about the Venmo debit card at venmo.com/card. The Venmo MasterCard is issued by the Bancorp Bank, N.A., ID verification required.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just $10.
$10 for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 18, Episode 33. This week, we heard the second half of Bob's conversation with Kevin and Anya from the Murder Sheet about the Delphi murders. As we've been diving into this for the past 2 weeks, it's been a really interesting conversation, and I cannot wait to put my thoughts into this. Today, we are sans Janet, but Bob and I have a lot to talk about. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
What we're going to do, I mentioned that we may have Kevin and Anya on this follow-up. They were not able to make it. They were last week, I think the day after we recorded, they were going on an international trip. I think they said they were going to Ireland, if I remember correctly. And I'd emailed them, and they said they may possibly be on this. I emailed them, and they emailed me back just a couple of hours ago. And like, man, we just got back. We got too much going on. We're not able to be on. So fortunately, they're not able to make the follow-up today. Also, I want to let you guys know, last week on the follow-up, I mentioned that I'd like to put together, I was thinking about putting together an episode that is just, now that the trial transcripts are available, going through and just laying out the facts of all the stuff that Kevin and Anya brought up, you know, because we've had perspectives from, you know, three attorneys that were there at the trial from the innocent perspective. We've had Kevin and Anya, who were at the trial from the guilty perspective. Kevin's an attorney as well. And so, but everybody has had like a perspective in their analysis of the evidence. And then throughout the discussions, not necessarily with them, but with, you know, on social media, through our follow-up questions, you know, our own kind of pontificating about what we think happened, there's just a lot of, there ends up being like all this gray matter, and you end up wondering what's real. At least for me, I was like, well, what's fact and what are things that are kind of people are presenting as facts,
right?
So I did end up doing that. I talked about this on our Patreon pregame show, but I put together notes after spending the last 2 weeks going through trial transcripts and cross-referencing everything and trying to make a list. I had chicken scratch, I had whiteboard scratch, I put it down in an outline of a document that's just an outline, is 18 pages long. So today I sat down to record that, and I had it laid out. Those 18 pages were acts 1, 2, and 3 of one episode. And then when I recorded it, act 1, which is all about all of the witnesses on the trail, which, by the way, this is embarrassing. There's only four. There's four witnesses, and me reading the first act of my outline took 1 hour and 4 minutes, or me breaking it down. And also, I should point out, that's no analysis. I intentionally put this, and so you know, that's what's coming. So now it's going to be definitely 2 weeks, possibly three, depending if I do the same thing for Act 2, where we're getting into the firearms analysis. My goal is to present all this evidence and not give you any kind of analysis, not tell you, you know, not break down what I think it might mean, but I just want everybody to have all the facts. So I go through all the witnesses. So, you know, this is what they testified to. This is what they said in their initial police report. This is what came up on cross-examination. This is what they said about the description. This is what we know about the times. This is what we, you know, all that. No bullshit, no fuller, no, you know, spin or bias put on it. Just like, this is what was said at trial. And this is what was challenged at trial based on prior statements. So, yeah. So this week is about, it'll be about an hour. Once. And by the way, huge shout out to Erica, because if you listen to that and it sounds good, that's all her. It is not me, because I'm not, it's not a script. I'm reading notes. So there's a lot of, and she cleans all that stuff up. So yeah. So this week's episode will be just me talking about all the trial evidence about the witnesses. Next week will be just me talking about the firearms examination and possibly, and the reason I think that'll probably end up being three, I think I can get through that in a reasonable amount of time. But then the next section is on the confessions and Dr. Walla and Judge Gall. That's, I've got a lot of notes about that because there's so much there where, you know, we hear from one side that she's this quack who was fired from her job and was obsessed with the case. Then we hear from the other side that no, she was a good psychologist and really cared about Richard Allen. And so I'm going through all the exactly what actually was said at trial and then a few hodgepodge things after that. So probably kind of the next 3 weeks. Getting that, all the breakdown of the case.
No, that's great. I'm really looking forward to hearing all that because I think it's important for everybody to hear. You know, we have, as much as I don't know how to say it properly, we've heard a lot of opinions and we've heard people stating things and not necessarily that they're saying they're, you know, stating it as fact, but they're stating their opinion and how they interpret the evidence. So it's I would really enjoy to hear the evidence in one place without bias, just what it says. And I think that would really help a lot of people, myself included.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, it helped me as I finished today's episode. You know, I kind of came out of it, you know, maybe rethinking a lot of the ways I thought about it. And when I say no analysis, like I do kind of at the end, tell you, you know, this is, you know, these parts of the evidence I think are, you know, I don't do too much analysis, but it's kind of, you know, for example, this time, I believe, is a strong time because there's a timestamp on a photo. We know when that time was.
Okay.
This time, I don't put much weight in because it's somebody's estimate of time. You know, things like that I put into it. But yeah, hopefully it'll be good. That's what's coming up. Still working with Bob Mata to have him come on and talk about the Lindsey Clancy case at some point. We were hoping to do that this weekend, but he's just swamped because he's on the road at the trial doing live streams and all that stuff on his own. But that should be coming up soon. And with that being said, Zach, you weren't here last week. So before we get into listener questions, and you know, if you have any particular thoughts or questions on the two episodes now that you've listened to.
You know, it's been a really interesting experience. It's been nice to sit back, to digest what Kevin and Anya had to say, and to see where the guilty perspective comes from. Now, I think listeners know, but I will put this out there. I'm very much kind of in the camp where you are, where I'm like, I hope beyond hope that Richard Allen is the guy, and I hope they got him. But I also hope they got the correct guy, and I'm very uncomfortable with how they got there. You know, and I said it. I hope beyond hope that this is the right guy, but hope is not evidence, and that scares me. You know, so it was nice to kind of hear Kevin and Anya break down the guilty perspective. There are some things that I didn't necessarily agree with, but that's part of it. I mean, that's part of having a healthy debate, or not even a debate, healthy conversation about this and seeing the two sides. There were some things over the course of the two episodes that I did have an emotional reaction to, you know, and I'm going to try very hard to state them as cleanly as possible. One of which, you know me as a firearms guy. I think a lot of listeners know me as a firearms guy. I am very, very, very uncomfortable with the part of the confession that says I did something to the gun.
Agreed. Same.
I am so uncomfortable with that. And here's where you see the sides coming in, right? Anya and Kevin clearly believe he's guilty. There's, you know, they see the evidence the way they see it. But when that was presented to Anya, she said, but that makes sense to me. And you said, well, you would say racket. And she says, well, you're a very articulate man. right? That's not, I'm not saying you're not an articulate man. That is so farce to me, because anybody that knows anything about firearms, anybody that owns a firearm knows the word rack. If you've ever seen a TV show that has a gun in it, they say the word rack. That is not a articulate way to describe what happened. No one that is operating a firearm is ever going to say, I did something to the gun, and not articulate right. what they did. Even if they don't use the word rack, they're going to say eject a round. They're going to say they moved the slide. They manipulated the slide. There's so many things to say.
They cocked the gun. It's not anything,
they cocked
right?
the gun. They're not saying yeah. I did something to the gun. I did something to the gun is someone that has no clue how a firearm operates. But as a person like Richard Allen, who even if he's not this crazy firearms enthusiast, if he's still carrying a firearm, he knows it enough. That's a huge
yeah.
thing for me.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And that's one of the areas that I'm really uncomfortable with, because like you said, and also like in Kevin and Anya's defense, you know, as they said, they know nothing about guns. So I think it's not even like a guilty or innocent perspective thing. I think for them, they're like, well, anyone that knows the word rack of a gun, that must be somebody that, you know, she said articulate, but, you know, somebody who is like very, very knowledgeable in firearms. Whereas like we know, as for people that, you know, that have guns, like, no, you don't have to be an expert. Like if you just, you know, have held a gun, you know, you know what that term is.
Right.
But what you said is the only person that would say did something to the gun is someone who has absolutely no clue about the gun. And why that makes me uncomfortable is because that seems like it describes Dr. Walla, which when you're getting a hearsay confession and she's saying, he said this, and I'm not saying this is what happened, but my initial gut reaction to that was, no, you said that. Right. You're saying that, because he would never have said that.
Right. I wholeheartedly agree, because that's where it comes from, right? And you know, there's somebody in the chat saying, well, that maybe she just didn't understand what he said and she just scribbled something. That's, if this is supposed to be this confession that's his words, that's not how this operates, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I want to point out, B. Hansen, thanks for the super chat, B, said in the chat that Anya called Richard Allen an extremely manipulative person and then said he wasn't articulate enough to say racked. You have to be articulate to be that manipulative. I think that's a fair point. And thanks again for the super chat, B. Yeah.
And I don't mean to harp on it, and I'm not by any means saying that Anya is laying it out there falsely or anything like that. But I'm just saying, like, from a point of view of somebody that is familiar with firearms, nobody's doing that. Like, that's just yeah. not a thing. And it was highly enraging to me during yeah. that point of the conversation. I truly, from the bottom of my heart, really appreciate Kevin and Anya coming on, having this great conversation and providing info. And they did provide some great info. Again, maybe I didn't fully agree with all of it, but they really put it out there and provided a lot of good information to people so they could see the guilty side. But there were little things like that that, in my opinion, are misleading. And maybe not purposely misleading, but they are misleading.
Yeah. And I mean, I wouldn't even go so far as to say misleading. I just think, like I said, I think that, like, I had the exact same reaction you did. I just think that in my hope is, and I think that it probably is mostly what it was is, you know, they are, as they said, so unfamiliar with guns. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, to them, it seems like only an expert would say something like that. Like it would be normal for, you know, because like you said, they don't live in our world. I mean, just in general, I mean, you were, you know, a professional, you know, tournament shooter. I just, you know, we just live in the rural Midwest and everybody has a gun here. So they, you know, in that world it's like, no. No one's going to say that.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. It's one of those things that really kind of, like I said, I had an emotional response to, but again, really happy to hear them talk about it. I think that it does help allow both sides to see that we can have informative conversations, regardless of if we come to a conclusion at the end that's on the same side of the fence. that we can have these nice conversations. I'm not going to harp on too much because I feel like there's a lot that's going to come out over the next couple of weeks when you present some of the facts that I feel like is there. But that was one of the things that really triggered me this week that I just could not hold myself back. Pun intended. That I could not hold myself back on.
Yeah. And, you know, along the lines of, you know, understanding where people are coming from, I'll say this is a little spoiler. I don't think I really articulate this in the episode because I didn't want to. That's coming Sunday. But, you know, I'll give you guys a little bit of insight now. When I went through for the episode that's coming Sunday, the witness statements and all of that, I was surprised because I had kind of formulated an opinion based on everything I had heard. Mm-hmm. I was surprised when I laid it all out how much I could, and not that they didn't state it or articulate it correctly, but just for the way my mind was working, I was very unconvinced mm-hmm. about the witness when Kevin and Anya broke that part down to me. And I was okay. Like, oh, if that's why, like, I get why you feel that way, but nah, I don't buy it. When I went through the trial transcripts and read it, I came away thinking, now I can see now why someone would buy that. Almost the point of like, okay, it's a coin flip for me. Like I could totally see someone leaning this way because of this part of the evidence, or I could see them definitely leaning the other way because of this piece of evidence, which I'll break down on Sunday. But it was a, you know, again, despite what some people may think, I really don't have a bias or a buy-in to this case at all. I just want to know the truth. And so I went into it that way. And I was surprised when I got done. I'm like, that's not how I thought I would think when I got done with this.
Well, that's good. That's good that you're doing, I'm going to say this is you're doing this exercise, but it's good to see, you know, going through the steps and really breaking down every aspect of this so that you can have as a unbiased decision or unbiased opinion as possible.
This is Matt Rogers from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
We've all been there. You get paid back for dinner and suddenly you have money in your Venmo balance.
With the Venmo debit card, you can spend your Venmo balance instantly. Plus, you can earn up to 5% cash back at some of your favorite brands.
You're earning cash back on things like groceries, rideshare, online shopping. It's giving responsible. It's giving the friend who somehow always has it together.
So if you're that friend who grabs the concert tickets, books the rideshare, and puts their card down at brunch, this one's for you.
Spend your Venmo balance with a Venmo debit card. No monthly fee, no minimum balance.
Learn more about the Venmo debit card at venmo.com/card. The Venmo MasterCard is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. See Venmo stash terms and exclusions at venmo.me/stash terms. Max $100 cash back per month. 5% requires $1,500 in qualifying monthly spend.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
The one other thing that I think you and Janet talked about a little bit, so I'm not going to go in depth, and it doesn't really matter, but I appreciated Anya talking about being in trial and hearing Richard Allen's voice. But I also mm-hmm. think that's another one of those situations where that's such a hard thing. That's, you know, you can kind of hear what you want, you know, and it's, I'm not saying that she wants to hear the voice of Richard Allen being the bridge guy, but if you're not an audio person, if you're a lay person, you know, like myself in the courtroom, if he talked, I could tell the voices are totally different if they're totally different, but if it's close, I can't tell that it's close if it's the same person or not. And I don't think anybody can.
And I don't think it's intentional on anybody's part on either side, but it is just a fact. Like once you mm-hmm. form it, and I kind of talk about this a little bit at the beginning of the episode coming Sunday about how what I'm realizing is there is a bias that seeps in, whereas people look at that as, oh, I've looked at this case. I've seen this case. I've decided Richard Allen, I think Richard Allen's guilty. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to look at all the evidence in that perspective. And there's a little bit of that, right? If you've formulated opinion beforehand, your brain, you know, without even meaning to, is going to try to, especially when it comes to things like, you know, hearing something like that, right? So like, right. You're hearing a millisecond of a very muffled off-camera voice and like, oh, I'm sure it's the same voice, right? Right. Or that other people are like, I'm sure it's a different voice. In reality, and Ani was very fair. She said like, this isn't evidence. It just was her observation, right? But I think that there is a bias that comes into where people even that like went into the trial open-minded, not knowing who was guilty, as they heard the evidence on layout, they used that data to formulate their conclusion. And then I think what happens is then when you look back on the evidence, this is tough for content creators like podcasters like us, because now you have to talk about and explain and articulate how you formed your opinion to people. And I think, and this is a very kind of nuanced thing, but I think it's like, if you've heard all the data in an unbiased way, use that to formulate your opinion. Now, when you look back at the evidence, now you're looking back at it through the lens of the opinion that you've already formed. I think that can cause someone to, oh, I'm sure I hear Richard Allen's voice, or it can cause somebody to say that's definitely not his voice. It can cause somebody to say, I'm sure I hear a gun cocking, mm-hmm. and you know, in the video, and then somebody else saying, I'm certain that's not a gun cocking. It can cause somebody to hear that be a gun. And yeah. Someone else to hear that we go down.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's like, as you formulated, you didn't formulate your opinion before you heard the evidence, but once you formulated it, it causes you to look at the evidence differently.
So just remind me really quick. So the that be a gun, who said that out of the two girls? Libby. So that be a gun obviously is bothersome. And I don't understand if that is the case, why people don't think that she said, Abby, that's a gun. That be a gun?
I don't know.
Listen, I am on your side. I do not think that's what's said, but that makes more sense to me than that be a gun.
Right. I think it's that causes people to, like, you can't say Abby, because Abby and that don't sound anything alike, right? So it's, and that is one of the areas where, to me, like that takes, and people will be really pissed off at me. And again, I'm telling you, I get it. I get why people think he's guilty. I fully understand it. I can see him being guilty myself. I'm not trying to shit on anybody's opinion, but that one element, I have done so much time and breaking it down to audio waves and looking at it and listening to it and slowing it down and everything. To me, saying that you're hearing her say that be a gun requires an incredible amount of mental gymnastics, an incredible amount. Yeah. On top of the fact that it doesn't sound like that's what she said, if you try to, like, because I even did the thing where I like typed that out and listened to it while reading that, like, I can maybe hear it if I do that. But then if you get there, then you got to get past the point, like, why would she say that be a gun?
Right.
And not gun, or there's a gun, or, you know, any other. And they're like, oh, it's just a way kids talk these, you know, it's to me, that one is, of every single thing that is involved in this case, that's the one piece of evidence where I'm like, man, that's a leap.
Yeah, that's pretty far-fetched to me. And I think I said it. I hope I came through. I do not know that Richard Allen is not guilty. Like, no, I don't think anybody could know, truthfully. But I'm not saying he's not guilty. He very well could be the perpetrator in this crime. I'm just saying there's too many things that we don't know, and that's bothersome.
Yeah, to me, this all, especially after doing this week's episode, and that's only a third of the three legs that we were talking about, I'm pretty firmly in the camp right now where I would have to vote not guilty because I have reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. It is not, I would vote not guilty because I'm sure he's innocent. It's because I see it. Now that I'm looking at it, I see it. I see where you guys are coming from. I see why you could vote guilty. I do see it.
Yeah.
But because of this and this present a reasonable doubt to me that I'm not sure, and you're supposed to be sure.
Well, you want to jump into some of these listener questions? I'm sure we've been rambling on for a few minutes here.
Yeah, let's hit up first. We had, so Kat, we mentioned this last week's follow-up. Listener Kat gave like a whole long, like bullet-pointed list of some kind of rebuttals to the stuff that came out from Kevin and Anya. And we didn't get to it last week, so I'll have you, why don't you go ahead and we'll kind of do them one at a time, and we'll try to just kind of bounce through Kat's list that I promised we'd get to it this week.
That's perfect. So Kat says, Brad Weber's gun could not be excluded and questions whether investigators test fired it. She also points out that the defense expert, Eric Warren, testified that he could review firearms evidence through macroscopic and microscopic photographs without personally examining the cartridges.
Yeah, and that's one we did kind of cover a little bit last week. But yeah, what we learned was that Brad Weber's gun, they said it was inconclusive. So, and that's another one where, depending on your perspective, neither's wrong, but how you say it, mm-hmm. right, changes how you're looking at it. So what I had heard from people making the innocent argument was Richard Allen's gun couldn't be excluded, but neither could Brad Weber's. I've repeated that because that's what I've heard from people, right? And I've seen like news reports that said something similar when that is true. But with Richard Allen's gun, they said they couldn't exclude it, and it had sufficient agreement enough for them to say that they think it likely came from his gun. With Brad Weber's gun, they weren't able to get enough tool marks to exclude it or include it. It was, I think, technically an inconclusive remark. So could it be excluded? No. Is there any indication the bullet came from that gun? Also no.
Right.
So it's kind of, they don't know. And that's where we talked a little bit about last week that, you know, I don't know. And we'll get into some of that, you know, the details of this in this week's episode. But as of last week, I don't know, like, did they try firing bullets from his gun like they did Richard Allen's?
Yeah. And I know you're going to dive into, I want to say one thing real quick about it. The one thing that really bothers me about it is the sufficient agreement, and that the expert, in my interpretation of all of this, basically gets on stand, says there's a sufficient agreement that these two cartridges match up, but they never actually present any evidence of it. Like, it's essentially like, take my word for it. There's sufficient agreement to these.
Well, we'll get into those details because she does explain it in the transcript, like why, like what elements cause her to make that determination. I just don't think nobody's really been like explaining that.
Okay. Because that's something I have not heard. But I also, the way I was interpreted was that there wasn't, like, they didn't present photos, they didn't present anything. It was just the expert talking about it.
Yeah, I think there was something to that. I'm trying to remember back. We'll get into that. I don't want to talk. I got a whole episode coming on. So we'll get into all that stuff.
Sounds good. Kat also says the route Allen described would have not taken his car past the Hoosier Harvestor camera.
Yeah, and that's one thing I'm waiting for, something Michael Osberg brought up, that there's a whole series, we've talked about this a couple times on the show, but there is an entire series of surveillance cameras that they have footage from all through town. I don't remember the number, but it was big. It was 20 some cameras, I think, that his car would have driven, but like that they should be able, they have this information, that evidence exists that can show exactly where he was and when he was there and when he got to the park and when he left. That was never, it was never presented. I don't know if it was like turned over. I don't know what the status of it is. But yeah, that was, if you watch Richard Allen's police interviews, you know, those videos, that's a whole long thing, is because the detectives are like showing him on a map, like, well, you came here and you parked here. And he's like, no, that's not, I didn't, I parked. And I think the place he parked was like not even on the map. He was like, he's like, no, it's not where. And it was like, they were trying to box him into, you came this way, which, as it turns out, I'm sure is because they had the picture of a similar looking car,
mm-hmm.
you know, on that camera. So they wanted that to be him. And he was telling them, no, I came from this way over here. I came from, you know, I came from the other direction. Yeah. So the way from where Richard Allen claims he drove in, yeah, he wouldn't have been on that camera at the Hoosier Harvest store. But it is yet to be proven one way or the other if he did drive that way. And again, that's another one of those pictures, like the stuff that Michael shared with us when he was on. You know, there's people that are like, I've seen the pictures, that's definitely his car. I've seen other people that are like, I've seen the picture, I've looked at the alignment, that's definitely not his car.
Yeah.
And it's tough because it's pretty fucking close. I mean, it's like it definitely, at a glance, that's his car. And then, but when you like look really close and start looking at where like the wheel wells align with the windows, and then there's like this box thing on the back of the back of the car that isn't on Richard, or that's on Richard Allen's car, or that's on the surveillance video car that's not on his car. You know, there's definitely room to question it there.
Moving on through Kat's points, she notes that Allen denied any involvement while speaking with Kathy, saying, "I didn't murder anybody. I didn't help someone murder anybody."
Yeah, and I think that's a response when they were asking me, you know, what I thought about when Kathy came in and he was, you know, when he was talking to her. So I think she's just adding to that and saying, like, yeah, he was saying, like, you know, I wasn't there. I, you know, I didn't do this. But then, like, yeah, there was more to that. He very clearly said to her, "I didn't murder anybody. I didn't help murder anybody." So, and again, it's just, I keep coming back to this, but I just think it's just worth people, not because you should be swayed by the other person's argument, because we should have more grace for people that disagree with us.
Mm-hmm.
In the fact that you can see, like, if you're on one side, like the part you're focusing in on is him saying, you know, trying to convince her he didn't go to the park that day or whatever. And if you're leaning towards innocence and you're focusing on the part that where he said very clearly, "I didn't do it."
So this point you brought up in the episode, but she argues that the trail witness descriptions do not match Allen, including a witness who was 5'7" and said she only came to the man's shoulder.
So that is, again, something I had heard, and Kat points out here. I get very in detail with that on Sunday's episode too. What I will tell you is that is two statements conflated together. Like, I've always heard it as one, like, okay, the one said I'm 5'7", and just, you know, briefly, one said I'm five, you know, very clearly I'm 5'7", and he was taller than me. The other one said I only, and she didn't say shoulder. She actually said I came up to like his upper forearm is what she said. But it never says, I haven't found how tall that person is.
Okay.
You know, if that was a very short person or whatever, but yeah, you are right that those two witnesses, their descriptions do not match Richard Allen. And I don't think there's any stretch you can make him match Richard Allen. But there's right. also, there's a lot more nuance. I'm like dying because I just want to dig into this, but I just spent an hour talking about it, and you guys are going to friggin' listen to it before I talk about it more. But yeah, that is, though, I've always heard that too. One said she's 5'7", and she only came to his shoulders. It's a conflation of two different statements together.
That's good to know. Kat notes that Allen described three girls, with one older than the other two, and says post-trial researchers have identified a separate group of three girls who are on the trails earlier that may fit that description.
Right. So, and I have not verified that because I was focused on the trial transcripts, but yeah. So that conflict we brought up while I was talking to Kevin and Anya, where, you know, again, for the millionth time, right? Like, that's the perspective thing. Well, Allen says, yeah, when I was coming to the trail, I ran into these three girls. There was an older girl with two younger girls. And then there's this group of four girls. There was two older girls and two younger girls who said they ran into a guy who looked like Bridge Guy. And, you know, again, from the defense side, it's saying, well, clearly they're describing the same event.
Mm-hmm.
If you're from the innocent side, you're saying clearly they're describing different events. He saw three girls. They were four girls. And this side can be like, nah, he maybe didn't notice there was a fourth one, or maybe he's lying, or, you know, there's a lot of different things. And again, I said this last week and I'll say it again. All these witnesses, none of them were testifying to the fact that they saw Richard Allen there. And that's a key distinction that I want to keep pointing out. They did not go to trial and say, yes, I saw Richard Allen at this time. All four witnesses from the trail testified that they saw the man that was in the picture. It was Bridge Guy, you know. So, and that is a distinction you need to keep clear. None of them said, "Yep, I saw that guy," and that was Richard Allen. They're all saying, "I saw that guy," and it was definitely the guy from that picture, Bridge Guy. So, okay. And there's a distinction there. So that there becomes another step where it's like, okay, first of all, do we believe they actually saw Bridge Guy? After that, if they saw Bridge Guy, now it's, is Richard Allen Bridge Guy? So okay. There's like two steps there.
She also notes that Betsy Blair's description was a young man with poofy hair in a larger, older model vehicle.
Yeah. So, I, by the way, I do need to circle back real quick to what I started to say there, and I lost, I derailed my own self as far as the three girls or four girls. The part I find interesting that I need to do some more research on, is that Kat said that there, and I've heard this, but I have not seen like verifiable source data on this, that that some people have been researching the case post-trial, because one of the things that Kevin and Anya said was there was no other group of girls. There was no group of three girls. They talked to everybody on the trail. The only group of multiple girls was this group of four. So it had to be. So it's kind of by process of elimination, it had to be then. One thing I was asking is, well, yeah, at that time, but what if he was right when he said 12:30? Was there anybody there earlier? Did they really, are they certain they talked to everybody on the trail? And so that, but you know, again, I'm not claiming this is fact because I have not verified it, but I have heard the same thing that people have identified there was a group of three girls there.
Interesting.
At some point. So that'll be, now back to the Betsy Blair description was of a young man, poofy hair, an older model vehicle. I'm confused about that because Betsy Blair didn't see. So Betsy Blair is the one who saw who she believes to be bridge guy standing out on the platform of the bridge. She okay. was going for a walk and her times were verified because she had a Fitbit on when she went up for a walk. She got to the bridge area, sees a guy standing out on a platform, and then she leaves. That's it. Very brief encounter, a few seconds. She was never closer than 50 feet away from him. I don't remember, unless I just didn't write that down because it wasn't relevant, I don't know how the vehicle comes into play there because she didn't see the vehicle. She just saw the man on the bridge. But as far as her description was a young man with poofy hair and large. The poofy hair thing is interesting, and I talk about that a little bit on Sunday's episode. Like a lot of them say poofy hair, but it's like you always wonder how much of that is police not feeding like in a nefarious way. Mm-hmm. But so you have, you know, Betsy Blair did not get a good look at this guy. She was not close to him. She's going for a walk, looks out, sees a guy 50 feet away. And by the way, of all the witnesses, she was probably, I want to say my favorite witness. But she was like, so to me, she was so credible on the stand. When she didn't know, she said, I always love it. I always love it when a witness on the stand doesn't know something and they acknowledge, I don't know. Instead yeah. of, and she was very good about that. But the poofy hair, they're all saying he's wearing like a hoodie and a face mask, but then also saying he has poofy hair. But I wonder, because one of the witnesses that saw him up close, Voorhees and Wilbur, the two girls that were in the group, that walked literally right past him and spoke to him, who they believed to be bridge guy. One of them said, or both of them say, that he had like poofy, maybe curly hair sticking out. And then Betsy Blair says it. And then later on, Sarah Carbaugh says the same thing. And I'm like, and so people, of course, you know, well, hang on that. Like they're all saying this, you know, Richard Allen didn't have poofy hair.
Right.
You know, but then it's like, to me, I can see how that came out. Mm-hmm. They have a witness that says, the man I saw had poofy hair. Now I'm questioning you, another witness, and you're describing him. What is a very logical question to ask you? Did the guy you saw have poofy hair?
Right.
You know, so that, you know, it's like people look at like, oh, the police are like, you know, coercing. Like that's not an intentional coercion. It is, and it's a reasonable question to ask, but it's also a way that you can see how that element becomes part of your memory now.
Yeah.
Because they're asking you specifically about a thing. But as far as the young man piece, like, yeah, I mean, that's true that, you know, she described him and the other ones described him as young. But I mean, again, Betsy Blair saw a man standing on the bridge from 50 feet away for a couple of seconds and didn't know that she needed to note anything about him.
Yeah.
Saying that she thought he was younger. Like, I don't know. I don't know how much weight I can put into that.
So you brought up Sarah Carbaugh, and Kat's last point is that she's actually raising concerns about Sarah Carbaugh's sketch because the sketch artist reportedly allowed Carbaugh to look at the bridge guy image during the process.
Yeah, well, and Sarah Carbaugh is another one. So Sarah Carbaugh is driving down the road, sees a guy on the opposite side of the road, walking the opposite direction, and passes him for a second.
Mm-hmm.
And then gives this, like, detailed description of it. You know what I mean? Like, how well did she actually see it? And again, Sarah Carbaugh, she, I think, of the three is the least, and I'm not saying she's lying, but as far as like credibility on the stand, to me, she was the least credible of all of them, just because her stories had a lot of, we've all heard the stories about the mud versus blood. She never said blood, then it became blood. Like, there's a lot of, but she also acknowledged on the stand that her memory was influenced by all the different photos and things that she was showing and media and everything else she didn't see. But again, like, I mean, yeah, it's a problem, but it's not that much of a problem because I don't think anybody convicted Richard Allen based on a sketch because he doesn't look like any of those sketches.
Right. That's correct.
You know what I mean? It'd be one thing if they drew like a spitting image of Richard Allen and they're like, ha, that's because they showed him pictures of Richard Allen. Like there's people, again, just like anything else, there's people that can look at that and twist and squint and be like, ah, that's I could see that's him. Just as easily as people can look at it and be like, there's no way that's him. But it's certainly not a dead ringer spitting image of Richard Allen.
Right. And that's, I mean, that's part of the hurdle of this case is the fact that they had two very distinctly different sketches that they released over the course of this. And I think that's a hard thing to come to grips with, regardless of what side you're on.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember which one was it. Carbaugh's was the first one. And then later they used Betsy Blair. I don't remember how they came out, but I always thought it was like someone came forward years later with a new sketch and that wasn't what was happening. They did sketches with two people, used one, and then later said, oh, maybe it's this one.
Yeah.
Is more like what happened. Hey, everybody. Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
We've all been there. You get paid back for dinner and suddenly you have money in your Venmo balance.
With the Venmo debit card, you can spend your Venmo balance instantly. Plus, you can earn up to 5% cash back at some of your favorite brands.
You're earning cash back on things like groceries, rideshare, online shopping. It's giving responsible. It's giving the friend who somehow always has it together.
So if you're that friend who grabs the concert tickets, books the rideshare, and puts their card down at brunch, this one's for you.
Spend your Venmo balance with the Venmo debit card. No monthly fee, no minimum balance.
Learn more about the Venmo debit card at venmo.com/card. The Venmo MasterCard is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. See Venmo stash terms and exclusions at venmo.me/stash terms. Max $100 cash back per month. 5% requires $1,500 in qualifying monthly spend.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
All right, so moving into the questions from this week, Carmen believes that Allen is guilty based on the combined evidence and cautions against treating his failure to confess during the police interview as evidence of innocence. She cites research suggesting that confession rates can be low in stranger or extrafamilial homicides, while she also does not support the Reed technique.
Yeah, I mean, it's not evidence of innocence, but it's, I mean, that's my job is to do statement analysis. And so when I'm looking at, when I'm watching it, it's not the fact that he didn't confess. I can promise you, I've never looked at a case and be like, oh, he didn't confess. He must be innocent. It's not as simple as that. It's very nuanced elements of the way he responded to certain pieces and parts of the Reed technique that were, again, not evidence of innocence, but indicators of veracity is the way is the way it's taught to me, right? So, and that was the thing. When they got to the point in the technique and in the interrogation process where they presented him with, the way that the Reed technique works, when they box you into a corner and present you with irrefutable evidence, right? That's how they put you on the scene. That's the place where the guilty person is supposed to, oh shit, they got me. Now let me come up with an excuse for this piece of irrefutable evidence. And police can lie about that, right? So like they could be like, the cop, usually it's because the cop has a hunch. They're sure this is the guy. They don't know, they don't have the evidence, but they're sure it was him. And they'll be like, well, explain to me why your fingerprints are on the crime scene. Or explain to me, your DNA is underneath her fingernail. So how is that possible if you've never met her before, right? And what they're looking for, even if that's not necessarily true, the guilty person, what they're looking for is for them to excuse it. So they'll be like, I've been to that apartment before. I have met her before. We've had drinks. It could have been, come up with some kind of excuse or in a denial. Usually it's a very soft denial. It's an I don't know, right? Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. I can't explain it. I don't know. Richard Allen's response to, we have a bullet from your gun on that crime scene, and it was proven beyond any question, it absolutely came from your gun. His reaction to that with astonishment. And again, I mean, you can say he's a psychopath, he's manipulative, he's acting. That wasn't my read on it, but that's just, that's my analysis. There's not, it's not evidence and not fact. But when me watching that and watching him go, I don't know, that's impossible. And no matter how hard they pushed, when they tried to go in hard, come out soft. I mean, this is not just like, the Reed technique is not just a process that gets a lot of confessions. I mean, it is. Okay, I've said this before, like in the textbook, it's psychological warfare. This is studied and proven psychological techniques to draw responses out of people, it's designed supposed to be to get people to tell the truth. We found out that it also gets people to admit to things they didn't do. But I mean, there are technical psychological reasons why it works. And when his response to that was just continued, like, there's no way, it's impossible. It's forcefully, that's impossible. That is a wild response. When they're telling you, we have scientifically beyond any shadow of any doubt proven with no possible question that bullet at that crime scene came from your gun. And your response is no fucking way. It's impossible. And then when they try to ease up on him and they're like, have you ever been out there target shooting? Maybe, that's where I'm waiting. Like, okay, I shoot my gun sometimes out there, or I was carrying my gun that day or whatever. But when he's just like, no, there's no way. I didn't have my gun out there. I didn't cock my gun out there. I didn't rack my gun out there. I've never shot my gun out there. There is no possible way that bullet came from my gun. Again, that's not, anybody else is more than welcome to hear that and be like, that means nothing to me, he's a liar. That's fine. But, I can only go off of my training and my education on the subject. And for me, that is an incredible indicator of veracity. You do not expect that response by someone with any kind of guilt in there. And it's not, and there's no like empirical data where it's like 100% of the time. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying for me, like, that detective had the same training I had. He's taken the same college courses I've taken. He's read the same books I've read on it. He's had, all the same thing. he was taught, as I was, that when someone responds in that way, that that should be read as an indicator of veracity, an indicator that they're telling the truth. So back to what you said, you know, Shih Tzu would caution against treating his failure to confess as evidence of innocence. It's not evidence of anything, but my particular analysis of that was shocking to me. That was something that got my attention, because it's very clear that didn't go the way it was supposed to go.
All right, that's good to know.
And actually, I'll say Sue in the chat makes a good point. And there's a lot of points like this. Two things can be true at the same time. Sue says, honestly, he could be telling the truth about the gun and still be the killer. That's true.
Yeah.
That, you know, there are other circumstances that could exist here. That, you know, and we'll get, and I know one of the questions here, we'll get into that another, but yeah, one doesn't have to be true for the other to be true.
That's a weird concept,
she said,
but yeah.
Which would be, Sue said, which would be super ironic.
Yeah. Listener Rebecca says, Anya says that Alan said something in his confession that only the killer would know, but never disclosed that. What was the guilty knowledge she was referring to?
The van.
And she did disclose it. It was the white van is what she was referring to.
I don't think
to.
She ever said, and the thing is that, but because our discussion, you know, I took the discussion in different directions, but yeah, that's what she was talking about.
Okay. Carl says, I find the strongest evidence of guilt to be that all of these people who were interviewed, they were on the trail that day and only saw one person that could have been Bridge Guy, and Alan was admittedly there, and he has some resemblance to Bridge Guy. So that makes me think, well, does that eliminate Rod and Logan, who arguably looks like Bridge Guy too? My question is about Rod and Logan and the location of his property and what path he would take to get to the area where Bridge Guy was on the photo from his property. Would Logan have been on the same trail with all these people where they were interviewed, or would he have been able to reach the area coming directly from his property to the location through the woods with being able to avoid everybody else?
That is such a good question. And it cuts directly toward, it goes right along the same lines as what I was just saying, how two things can be true at the same time. We know Richard Allen was at the crime scene. We know people saw a guy that they believe was Bridge Guy at the crime scene. There's possibly an overlap in time. Let me put it this way. And again, I'm trying not to get too far ahead, but the group of four girls, the two older girls, both tested. They walked right by him. One of them said hi to him. They got a very good look at him, very close. Both said, the guy that I saw was Bridge Guy. Betsy Blair saw a guy matching Bridge Guy's description standing on the bridge. I think that the trap we can fall into is by assuming and or insisting that they saw the same guy. It's not necessarily true. It ends up being that, but is it possible that the four girls saw Richard Allen and Betsy Blair saw a different guy? We want to say no, but is it possible? Well, look at the details of what they said. Were the clothing descriptions exactly the same? Were the heights exactly the same? No. It's been said over and over again, right? Like, oh, the guy was wearing a big blue Carhartt looking jacket. That's weird for the Midwest. Yeah. Sarcasm.
Yeah.
It's everybody in the, you know what I mean? Like, it's not an odd outfit to wear. Or other way around, could it be? Because here, I'll tell you this. Betsy Blair saw the killer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 1,000% convinced Betsy Blair saw the killer. And you'll hear why Sunday, because those are some timing issues that are hard timestamps. She saw the killer. That man she saw on the bridge. Betsy Blair gets to the bridge, sees a man standing out there on the platform, turns around and walks back down the trail and passes Libby and Abby walking to the bridge. Libby and Abby get to the bridge. We know from their phone records a couple, like 3 to 5 minutes later, 2 minutes later than that, they're taking a Snapchat photo of Abby on the bridge. And 5 minutes after that, they're making the video. Betsy Blair saw the killer for sure. The question is, was that Richard Allen? Is the guy she saw for sure the same guy that the other two saw? That's where the question comes in. Now, to the heart of Carl's question, Ron Logan. And I don't discuss him at all in these episodes because it just muddies the water. We're trying to go with evidence that was at trial. But for the purposes of this discussion, Ron Logan's property, was on the other side of the bridge. So it is possible that Ron Logan, in a world where, let's say Ron Logan did this, I don't feel bad talking because Ron Logan was a pretty horrible guy. So from the other stuff that he did, so I don't feel bad talking about him like this, but this is a possibility. I'm not saying this is what happened, but yeah, Ron Logan could have left his property, got onto the bridge from the other side, walked across and been standing on that platform. It would have never passed anybody on the trail, but Betty Blair would have seen him standing there.
Interesting.
That is a, and again, I don't go running to, well, Bob said that Ron Logan, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying in a world of could he, is it possible? 100% it's possible that he could have done that. And there's nothing to indicate that he did or didn't do that. You know, so there's I'm certainly not suggesting that's what happened. But the answer to your question is, yes, Ron Logan could have got to the bridge, been standing on that platform when Betsy Blair got there, and have never walked down the trail and crossed anybody else's path.
All right. So Kara has a few points here. Kara says, I may be really naive, but I don't believe that a person suffering from anything but psychosis would be eating their own feces. Anything that he said during that period, I don't put any credibility in.
I agree. And that's one of the things I want to get at, as far as like things that, like you said, you were like, triggered by, I hate that word, but triggered by the,
yeah,
by the gun stuff that got me. And it got me only because I know what I've heard Dr. Walla testify to and what I've seen in like the news reports. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to get in the trial transcript, because Kevin and Anya, I think it was Anya, had said that, you know, I don't think he was suffering from psychosis. Mm-hmm. And that bugged me, because everything I'd read was Dr. Walla, the person they said cared about him so much and is a great psychologist, to my understanding, clearly diagnosed him as being severely psychotic, in right. a state of psychosis. And so I'm very comfortable with, you know, something like that be a gun there, you know, that we go down interpreting what we're hearing, different opinions. I am not comfortable when the doctor diagnoses somebody with something and then we say, yeah, but I don't think they had that. If that's the case, I don't like that.
Yeah. Kara's next point. I would love to see a timeline and the bridge sightings as a diagram. It wasn't until this week's follow-up that I was even aware that there was two bridges.
Yeah. I guarantee you there's got to be a graphic out there somewhere. I'm hoping that my episode Sunday will clear. If I didn't jump around too much, I tried to. So the format of the episode, I gave you up top, like the timeline at a glance, where I just went through, here's basic times and where things happened. Then I went through all the statements, and at the end, I circled back again. So I think I've laid it out in a way that it makes sense. I can, or somebody, you know, one of our listeners, I'm sure can do this, put together a good graphic of that. But I'm certain there's probably one. If you Google timeline of sightings in Google and hit images, I bet you somebody has already done that. So I would check that.
Definitely. Kara's last point is, in such a fleeting moment, we get to see Bridge Guy in Abby's video. I don't know how anyone could positively ID someone they've simply walked past as being one from the same person.
Yeah, so the way it went was the witnesses walked past somebody and they saw someone. And there was, and again, the group of four girls, the two that testified, you know, they had an interaction with him. Voorhees actually said, you know, said hello to him and he didn't respond to her or something, right? So they like had this interaction with a guy that they thought, that guy's creepy or weird or whatever. Again, though, it's, you know, as Janice pointed out, and we talked about all the time, like eyewitness testimony is terrible, like, they weren't clocking, he's this tall and he was wearing this color and his eyes were this color. They're not clocking that because they're not, right. They don't know anything's happening, right? So they walk by. And then, so they're giving the police a description of, I saw a guy, he looked like this, dot, 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 dot. And then the picture came out. And one of them was like that evening, one was like the next day. And they're like, that's the guy. I don't have any problem with that. Is it 100% accurate? No, because again, the problem is what the guy was wearing is something very, very, very common mm-hmm. for people to wear in the Midwest that time of year. So it's, you know, it's not like 100%. It's not like the guy was wearing like a Hawaiian shirt or something that was very memorable. He's wearing a very normal outfit for that area. But yeah, I don't have a problem with somebody saying, yeah, I saw a guy on the bridge. I don't remember exactly what. And then they see a picture and I'm like, that's the guy. Like, you know, to me, that's fair. That's pretty credible, I think.
Okay. Jordan's question is more about last week's episode, but they are curious what Richard Allen looked like in early 2017. Was he heavier and didn't have any facial hair? Their impression is that Bridge Guy was stocky and clean shaven.
So, and I don't know where that comes from. Well, the stocky part, I know where it comes from. I meant to look this up earlier, I believe that Richard Allen he's heavier than he was at trial. He lost a bunch of weight in prison and mm-hmm. got really kind of emaciated. So he was heavier. His face was fuller. But I believe he always had like that long goatee. I don't know if Zach, if you can look up it real quick, if you can find like a 2017 image of him.
Yeah, I'll try to pull one up. I do remember, I've always seen him with a goatee. I know that I've always seen him like that, but that doesn't mean that's what he looked like.
Yeah,
let's see what we can find. Like 2017.
As far as the clean shave, so the girls that were the closest to him, that walked past Richard Allen, the ones that walked back who they claim was the man in the image, Bridge Guy. They describe, matter of fact, there's a lot of discussion at trial where they're talking about was he bigger. He was a big guy. And there's a lot of discussion of, did they mean muscular? It's really kind of unclear. Like, they're not necessarily saying he was muscular, but he was a big guy. They say younger. But they also, both of them say he had a face covering on, like a runner's mask that was covering him from like halfway down his nose down. So as far as clean shaven, like that's something people are saying. That's not from their testimony.
So every photo I can find of him from that time period seems to have some sort of facial hair, whether it's a beard, whether it's a goatee, whether it's a shorter goatee, always seems to have some. That doesn't mean he was like that, but everything I can find quickly seems to have some sort of facial hair.
Yeah, I've never seen a picture of him without it. But yeah, but again, I think clean shaven, like I don't, you know, because there is, like, there's one report where one of the witnesses says he had a square jaw. And then they're asked, you know, during cross, like, you said he was wearing a face covering. How do you know he had a square jaw? And her response was like, good question. Basically, like, I don't know. I thought that.
Yeah.
Which, again, it's why eyewitness identification sucks.
Right.
Because, you know, she's not doing anything wrong. It's like, people don't understand how easily memories are manipulated. It just happens. Things come in and your brain will turn like new information into like part of your memory. And then it just becomes like, it's a fact.
So Sonia says, the only thing currently that would convince me of Richard Allen's innocence would be if the FBI report said Bridge Guy has to be over 6 feet tall. Can Bob get a hold of that report and tell us what it actually says? Nothing else I've heard surrounding this case has convinced me one way or the other.
No, nobody has that report. All we have is the FBI's probable cause affidavit to search Ron Logan's home. Ron Logan was tall. I think he was like 6'3". And as part of the probable cause by the FBI was that Ron Logan was of similar build to the man in the photo. And so you can take that to mean what it means. Like, you know, when I look at it, I'm like, well, if a major identifying part of his build is his height, and they're analyzing the photo and determined that the height could be 6'3", I did not look into this for this week's episode, but it'd be worth looking into, because I want to say there was an analyst that testified that said that Bridge Guy was between like 5'7" and whatever the range. What I remember from it was the range that the expert said that the height could have been. Richard Allen was not in that range. It was like 5'7 to 5'10, 5'7 to 6', and Richard Allen's 5'4". Mm-hmm. He's short.
So this gets to our last question, and it's from Kate. And Kate says, are you going to be done with this case and concentrate on new investigation, or are you going to even the pro-guilt episodes by having two other pro-guilt podcasters or YouTubers on? Love Kevin and Anya, but their time limit, as well as their choice to narrow their preview on why he is guilty, did not provide a full picture that they have done on their podcast and their book, and Tom Webster's Pro Guilt episodes.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like we're kind of doing this to death. If there's other, I'll look into it. What I want to know is, was Tom Webster there? Because what I've tried to do is have people, especially because when we started doing this, it was none of the transcripts were available. So the only way we had any idea what happened at trial was to have people on who were at the trial, and they were all, you know, these were attorneys at the trial, including Kevin. So I don't know if that I've never heard of Tom Webster, if he was somebody who was there. Maybe I would want to have a conversation first and see if he's going to offer anything new. I mean, because like Kevin and Anya, I didn't like hamstring that. I don't think they have as long as they want.
Mm-hmm.
Make the argument, and that's, you know, they felt was the best argument. And as I said, when I did research on it, you know, I was convinced isn't the right word, but I was more understanding of the guilty argument based on me researching the things they were talking about than the way they described them to me, just the way my brain works, right? The way I was hearing it. But if Tom Webster has, you know, or somebody has some new bit of evidence that I haven't heard, the big thing I wanted to do with the, you know, somebody coming from the guilty side is I wanted to know, and I feel very confident that Kevin and Anya would have brought it up if that was the case. What I want to know is there evidence of guilt that we don't know about, right?
Okay.
Because, right, you know, because it's like, yeah, we heard everything Bob had to say. We heard everything that Andrea had to say. We heard everything that Michael Osberg had to say. And it was like, are they leaving something out? Not that I thought that they were leaving something out, but I know that like listeners can feel that way. Like, if they don't trust the, you know, any of them for whatever reason, if they're like, oh, well, they're probably hiding something. So I wanted somebody from the other side that could come on and be like, you know, well, what they didn't tell you was XYZ, right? And on the contrary, and as I said this, I think I said this last week, but it was refreshing to know that, you know, when the discussion came out, at least from Kevin and Anya's point of view, it wasn't a matter of they left evidence out. It was a matter of how they weighed evidence and how important it was to them compared to, you know, from one side or the other. You know, whereas, you know, somebody would look at the confessions, right? So we all know what the confessions are. We know what was said. That's all out there. And it's this side thinks the confessions are nonsense and they don't mean anything because of the psychological conditions, because they came from Waldo, whatever the reason may be. They don't think the confessions are any evidence of guilt. Whereas someone on the guilty side is like, he confessed. I think that's incredible evidence of guilt. So there wasn't like there was, you know, one side saying there was a confession and the other side saying there wasn't one. It's just a matter of, you know, how people weigh it. So for me to eat up any more airtime besides the four different guests we've had on it, the episodes we've done on it, the follow-ups we've done on it, and the 2 to 3 episodes I'm about to do on a case that's not our case, I think we got it pretty much covered, unless somebody points out to me there's something else out there that we haven't talked about yet on here. Because again, you know, Kate, like I appreciate where you're coming from, Kate, but like my goal here is not to convince anyone of anything. I don't care what everyone thinks. My goal is to make sure, and it's like you mentioned, like balancing it out. Like it's, again, it's not like a debate or you know, like a game that I'm trying to even out. I'm just trying to get as much information as possible out to all of you so that there's a source so you can all, you know, have informed opinions on the case. And, you know, I'm not involved with the legal team. I'm not involved with the litigation. It's, you know, nothing that we're doing here is going to affect what happens, you know, as far as justice is concerned moving forward. So, yeah, long answer. Here's the short one. If someone comes to me and says, here's something you haven't talked about yet, a thing that exists that you haven't brought up, then I'll be happy to share that. But I just don't want to put more time in it for the sake of putting more time in it, because I had 3 people on talking from one side and 2 people talking from a different angle. And yeah, with that being said, I hope, Kate, you'll be satisfied with these episodes that are coming up. And for anybody that's on either side of the case, you know, like I said, I'm trying to lay out everything you're going to hear from me in these next few episodes is exactly what came out at trial. And it's left up to you to determine how you weigh that. So make sure you turn in on Sunday. It's a whole hour about the timeline and all the witnesses from the trail. I think people on both sides may be surprised by what they hear. And if you go into it with open mind, I'll tell you this, I don't think if anybody goes into it with an open mind and they really are listening to see if there's something there that leans in one way or the other, you're not going to walk away from that episode going, I figured it out. You're most likely going to walk away from the episode like I did, like, oh, shit. Like, it's like, well, that's that. I can see how A plus B, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. I can see how that adds up, but I can also see how things are a little different. So anyway, listen to that. We've been rambling. We're over an hour again. That's two over hour, three counting the pregame. I've been behind this microphone for 3 hours a day. Done. So we'll talk to you guys all about, make sure you tune in Sunday, and we'll talk to you guys about that information on next week's follow-up. See you guys.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
This is Amy Brown from Feeling Things with Amy and Kat. Back to school season always feels like a fresh start, not just for kids, but for all of us. It's a great reminder to create new routines and find meaningful ways to connect with our family, friends, and community. Hasbro Games make it easy to gather around the table. Put the screens away, share some laughs, and create joyful memories together. Whether it's Monopoly, Connect Four, Guess Who, or another family favorite, there's something for everyone. You can find these and other Hasbro favorites at your local Walmart, walmart.com, or simply tap the link in today's show notes to bring more play into your week.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I like things my way. My coffee, my schedule, and my treatment. So I talked to my doctor about self-injecting with the VivGuard Hytrulo prefilled syringe, which contains efgartigimod alpha and hyaluronidase QVFC. It's injected under your skin, subcutaneously. It means I can inject in my space, on my time. It's my treatment, my way. Visit VivGuardMyWay.com. That's VYVGARTMyWay.com. And talk to your doctor about VivGuard Hytrulo, brought to you by Argenix.